Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. This interview was also recorded in high-definition video and can be viewed at mormonstories.org, on YouTube at youtube.com/mormonstories, and in iTunes as part of the podcast feed. You made a really interesting point in here, and I'm going to just read from it. If my house had been destroyed by fire, if my child had been run over, I could call on the church. Mm. The church would be wonderful, but not this. I could not bear it. Gerald might be excommunicated, and I would be humiliated and pitied. And then you also talk about little later on, when some ladies from the Relief Society came to visit you, and they asked you how you're doing, and you said, "We're fine. We're all fine."
Oh, yeah. We say that.
And then you asked that question, "Did every woman in the ward who had a real heartbreak lie about it like I was lying? Did we need so badly to look as bright and happy as the perfect family on the front of the ensign that we smiled no matter what the cost?"
Yep.
I guess you didn't end the book this way, and we'll talk about the ending in a little while, but you didn't end with this theme that the church wasn't there for you. But it's clear that there were some ways in which the church just could not be there for you. And can't be there for other people.
Right. In terms of dealing with the issue, the church was not a resource for me. Not at all. But then, and I will be happy to talk about, you know, at the very end, that's where Mormons come through. When there's physical stuff to be done, and often they can put away their judgment and say, "I don't get it, but Sister Pearson needs us."
Then they come through. So there's a point in San Francisco when Gerald brings you a man that you call Sam, who tells you about what he had gone through at BYU. Can you talk about that meeting with Sam? And I've got some quotes if you don't quite remember.
Sure. And I think I had met him early in Provo, but what you're speaking of, we saw him again later on. This was after he had been beaten up by, he had been gay bashing. He had lost an eye. And I did know his story. He had told me his story of, he's one who went through shock therapy at BYU.
Talk about that for a bit, for those who don't know.
Well, one of the supposed remedies for homosexuality, and this was certainly not just in the Mormon community, this was nationally something that certain kinds of psychiatrists or whatever felt would be a useful thing, of reprogramming one's sexuality by associating pain with the unwanted and pleasure with the wanted, so that these men would voluntarily go. These Mormon men, and I know the women do have similar kinds of heartbreaks, but it's the men whose stories I know on this particular thing. Mormon men would just about do anything to not be gay. And so at that time, and at BYU, there were psychologists or whatever system was there to use shock therapy, which in this case was putting electrodes on a man's body, on his penis, on whatever parts of his body that would, and then show him some pornographic kinds of pictures. And if there was any kind of arousal toward that the body presented, he would receive shock and would be burned on his whatever part of his body was hooked up. And then he would be shown pictures of women in alluring and erotic pictures, and there would not be the shock. So many of these men went through that session after session after session until the burns on their body. But mostly it just destroyed their inner self. Their psyches were so broken, and everything they believed about themselves was just so damaged. And of course, nobody was changed in their sexuality. Some people were made so that anything about sex was so revolting to them. And maybe those are the only success stories. So yes, and what did I call him in the book?
Sam.
Sam? Yes, he was one of those. And as I remember, he had done everything early on. He had used his own money to go to a therapist before he told his parents. I borrow some of these little bits of stories when I created Facing East. Yeah.
So there was a time in San Francisco where you decided to trust Gerald again. So after he had betrayed you.
Well, Gerald and I pretty much came to an understanding that there would be a period of time where he would promise me that there would be no activity, and I would promise him I would learn everything I could about the subject, and we would just see how we would work. And so, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that bargain was kept. But Gerald did want to introduce himself. He wanted to go to a gay father's meeting in San Francisco. He needed to all of his identity have some kind of contact. So, and you know, and I will never know precisely what he may have done at whatever point. But as it became clear to us then by 78 that the only way we could salvage any kind of relationship was to divorce.
You know, when a just a traditional spouse cheats on the other spouse, just heterosexually, one time, that can be not only an immediate deal breaker, an immediate divorce, but it can lead to eternal hatred and animosity of immense proportions, where the offender is demonized and loses all rights and privileges and becomes hated forevermore, erased from any sense of love or compassion. And some would argue that doing it as a gay person with maybe even multiple partners would be beyond unforgivable. Yet you, like, not only gave him another chance, but seemed to embrace him and love him and understand. How did you arrive at that? Why wasn't he kicked out, kids taken away, relocated somewhere, and he became the evil bad one that we were not to talk about, or if we did, he was to be demonized?
I don't know. That's just not the way I saw it. And in that first shock in Provo, when I realized neither one of us wanted the family to end. Gerald told me the worst fear in the world he could think of was that he would no longer have me and his children and in his life. And I knew that was true. And somehow, I mean, I was thrown into a totally new geography that I had no help in walking, that here was this awful, evil thing that had been thrust into my life. But I knew that Gerald, in his being was not an evil man. I knew that. And so really, just day by day and bit by bit, I tried to piece together and figure out what was to be done. And I always knew that I would not be able ever to sustain a marriage where fidelity was not part of it. And then when we did decide to end the marriage, you know, I could go back and second-guess myself all the time and say, okay, maybe at that point, well, no, I thought about, well, should I move back to Utah? Should I take the kids away from him? Is he a bad influence on the kids? Is whatever. And I just didn't ever come to a place of saying, I need to keep him away from the children. I need to take them away. And I'm not saying that this is the only right way that somebody could face a situation like this. And I think I would respect a lot of people who would make a totally different decision on this. I'm just saying that in my particular case, step by step, this seemed to be the step that I could live with the best. And then after the divorce, to maintain a friendship with Gerald seemed to me more correct than cutting him off.
And the kids loved him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he would come out first twice a week and then once a week. And but I'm not telling you at all that this was a perfect situation. Or if I could go back, there are things I would do that Gerald became more of a friend to the kids than a father. And he brought especially Emily into his life in a way of wanting her to approve him and that was inappropriate. So there are a number of things that I would go back and say, boy, not that, not that, not that, not that. But at the moment, that I didn't have a clear bead on that. Gerald and I agreed that the kids could go in to visit him and they would not see anything that would be different from... I mean, of course, that's an outrageous wish of mine. But anyway, things played out as they did. And then, as you know, we come to the end of the story. And shall we just go on to the end of the story, or do you...
It sounds like a heady and a terrifying time to be a gay man in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I get the sense that he was terrified about this decision of, I don't want to give up my family. I love my children. He loved you. But he felt like he couldn't suppress this part of him any longer.
That's absolutely true. And somebody on the outside would say, oh, come on. But that is how he experienced it. And he's, I probably put it in there. He said, if I could cut off an arm or a leg or all of them, I would do that to expunge this problem for us. But I can't. It's who I am. And as I knew, the minute I met Gerald, he was hungry for experience, for knowing, for learning, for figuring out who he was and what everything else was. Gerald was not a person that could put a lid on him and say, okay, that's all now, just shut up and be quiet. So he continued to explore what to him, and many people would say this is totally insane, to him was emotional, sexual, spiritual learning. And of course, what you say is true. It was an insane time in San Francisco. And all of these people who had been so alone and suppressed and told how evil they were, to find a place that accepted them. And all of these crazy things were, you know, a little kid in the candy store who finally able no limits. There was craziness going on. And I saw Gerald trying to, Gerald wanted a partner that he could truly be with and live with and grow old. Oh, yes. That's what he wanted.
And he kept trying.
He did.
And he kept bringing you his boyfriends.
Okay, yeah, a number of them. And I went to the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus because Gerald asked me to. And saw these men marching down the aisles in white, seeing if my friends could see me now, as I sat there weeping. And the lady next to me said, "Who are you here to see?" I said, "My husband." So, yeah, and listen, I am not saying that this is the way everybody should play out such and such a scenario. I am only saying this is how it played out for us. And from moment to moment, I just did the best I could.
And that chorus was sort of his creative...
Oh, he didn't begin it.
But it was his creative high point.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And he was producer of the first national tour of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And he was deeply proud of that.
And Dianne Feinstein was the mayor at the time. Yeah. And there was a big...
Oh, listen, do you know what? When I saw the movie Milk, or before I went to see it, I got into my diary to see what was going on, just because I remembered that Gerald had said, so I found this place in my diary. I found it rapidly. The day that Harvey Milk was shot, Gerald called me that night. He was so stunned, as everybody was. And he had 2 weeks prior had lunch with Harvey Milk. And he told me that Harvey had said to him at that time that he was taping his whole story and his goals for the gay community because he felt that he was not going to live for a long, long time. And there was just 2 weeks after that that he was killed, and the choice that Dustin Lance Black made in creating the screenplay was Milk sitting at his table, speaking into his tape recorder. So, and as Gerald called me, he was so distressed. And he went to the candlelight vigil. And I remember him crying in that conversation. Oh, yes, he was going to the candlelight vigil, and there was going to be possibly a lot of violence going on. I mean, who knows what was happening? There had been. No, excuse me. This was the time when the verdict came that Dan Brown and his Twinkie defense was getting off very, very lightly. That's when San Francisco erupted, and cars were turned over, and all of this. And Gerald called again at that time and said, "I'm going to go to the vigil." And he said, "I just wanted to call and tell you and the kids again that I love you so much in case something happens to me tonight." So he was deeply involved in all of that stuff. And it meant something historically and personally to him that was huge.
Milk was there, Martin Luther King.
Yeah. And I think that's a very important movie that people should see, the movie Milk. So yes, Gerald went out hunting for his true love. And as I comment in the book, he said to me at least once, "Oh, Blossom, if I could ever find a man like you, I'd be in seventh heaven."
Painful words to hear from
you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So should we just go on to the end of this?
Yes. So yeah. Multiple boyfriends with the hopes of finding the true love, never found it.
Yeah.
Then he got sick.
Right. And Gerald had been sick for about a year, but he did not dare go in for testing. And of course, that we found out about the AIDS virus. It was a brand new thing. Nobody knew why it was striking gay men. It was all brand new stuff. And this was 84. Gerald had been ill in 83, and then... in March of 84, he finally went in and got tested. And I think it was by phone, he called and told me that he had tested positive for the virus. And then he came out that week, and then we told the children. And but Gerald was going to beat it. And, you know, when there were all of these, you know, certain things being discovered, the virus was isolated, and people thought maybe, you know, we can quickly handle this. And Gerald was full of optimism, and he did his affirmations. Listen, I've got about 5 notebooks of Gerald writing out his affirmations on the pages. I am well. I am, you know, all of these good things. I am a valuable son of God. And during this last part of his life, he was deeply anguished about Mormonism, about the condemnation that he had always had to live through, that he felt was part of the reason he was vulnerable to getting this illness. And at one point he said to me, you know, I don't hate the church. The church hates me. And there was such tremendous distress there about the kind of God that had always been created for him by, you know, the only religion he had ever known. When he left the church, he found a lot of ways to maintain a spirituality. And it was important to him to try to help other gay people who had left or been kicked out of their churches know that they were still spiritual beings. That was terribly important to him. And he devised these lessons that he gave about meditation and about our oneness and everything. But anyway, he had a lot of spiritual anguish going on right up to the end. And so it was in July that he did pass away. And when he first became ill, you know, and I'm not saying this is how the decisions that everybody would be appropriate for everybody. But I said, Gerald, do you want to come out and be with us? And he didn't, because he needed the medical benefits in San Francisco. And anyway, coming toward the end of the story here, the kids and I had gone for away for vacation, and he had been in my house for while we were gone. But when we came back, we knew. I'd had my friends come in to make sure he was okay and to whatever. But when we came back, he was just a shell. We'd only been gone about 2.5 weeks. And so I sent the kids to be with a friend while I figured out how to handle all this. And I thought it would probably be, who knew, months. His doctor told me it could be months. But so Gerald was there at my home for the last week or week and a half or whatever it was, and his mother came in to help. And so he was there on my couch. And yes, here is where you're remembering that I asked my friend Annie Moss to go give the information to the bishop. And then the good Mormon machinery came into action. And, you know, this is worth shedding some tears about. Because, you know, when, as I wrote there, here Mormons who can't even understand the idea of homosexuality, but they understand pain. And so my dear visiting teacher, Sister Spencer, called and said, now, I'm not going to ask you what you need, or I'm not going to say, call me if you need something. She said, I'm going to call you at 9 o'clock every morning, and you give me the list. So I did. And dear Ted and Ola Merle Christensen came over and spent an hour, or I spent a whole day out in the cleaning the yard, the backyard. And course, that was a really difficult time, obviously, in every possible way. But there was some peace there. And I was going to bring the children back. But when I saw that it was going so rapidly, I just made the decision not to. But the kids spoke to Gerald on the phone.
There's a point in the book where he's really sick and you decide to climb into bed with him.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you're saying?
What, did I sing him the lullaby, some lullabies? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Gerald was, toward the end, he couldn't speak a lot. And he had some physical distress. And one night I did climb into bed with him. And just was up against him and held him. And I was singing him the lullabies, the angel lullaby that I had written for Emily while she was still in utero, and the one that has become quite well known in My Turn on Earth. And
how does it go? You don't have to sing? You don't have, if you want.
Just a sec. You came from a land where all is light, to a world half day, a world half night. To guide you by day, you have my love, and to guard you by night, your friends above. So sleep, sleep, till the darkness ends, guarded by your angel friends. Oh, sleep, sleep, till the darkness ends, guarded by your angel friends. There's one stands softly by your bed, and another sits close with a hand on your head. There's one at the window watching for the dawn, and one waits to wake you when the night is gone. So sleep, sleep, till the darkness ends, guarded by your angel friends. Yes, sleep, sleep, till the darkness ends, guarded by your angel friends. I've sung that lullaby to gay men over the phone. So, yes, and then I remember Gerald got sick. And I had to clean us both up. You know, dying is a messy thing. But I remember, too, and I probably tell it in there, and this is pertinent to a lot of things we're going through today, culturally. There was one, I was, toward the very end, Gerald was sleeping on the couch in the front room, and I was sleeping on the other couch in the nearby in the family room. And he started calling out, come on, come on, come on. And I went in and said, what's happening, Gerald? And he had purchased one ticket to La Cage aux Folles, the musical play, when he still had a little money. And it was coming, I don't know, months and later. And he was so... He was lying there in sort of a delirious state. He told me, I'm in the theater, and I'm waiting for La Cage aux Folles, and they won't open the curtains. They won't open the curtains. So he was lying there, come on, come on. And he didn't ever get to see La Cage aux Folles. And I want to mention that here because La Cage aux Folles was really the first time that a gay relationship had been portrayed in the musical theater as a romance. And I heard an interview with Jerry Herman, the writer, about the phenomenon that that was. It was the first time that on stage there was a love song that one man sang to another. And I guess I want to bring that up because one of the things we don't get is that gay men actually fall in love and would sing a romantic song one to the other. Because so many of us think that it's just some little evil twist. But it's not falling in love the way real people fall in love. But that's what that play represented to Gerald. And that's what he wanted. I mean, he wanted for gay people to have their relationships honored in a way that they could be nourished and be a couple the way that the couple was portrayed in La Cage aux Folles.
Those are some of his dying thoughts.
Yeah. So that's just one memory I have of those last difficult days. And then I was feeding him carrot juice and carrot juice and carrot juice. And but then, you know, when we knew it was the end, I just gave him ice cubes. And and I play the guitar for him. And I got out his Walt Whitman book, and I read some of his pieces that he had marked to him. So then it was, you know, it was just a very quiet ending of his life there on the couch.
I love the last couple paragraphs in the conclusion of Goodbye, I Love You. Would you mind reading those?
Oh, when Gerald was dying, we talked about that we'll have a picnic in the next life when we know more, and we'll just get to talk about all this. So here at the end of the book, Gerald and I will have our picnic. I'm planning it now, our many picnics. After I have traveled the tunnel and been welcomed into the light, I will search the faces for one of my favorite people, and he will be there. Gerald and I will walk together and laugh and embrace, sealed as friends forever, through years of tears and hopes and joys and devastation, and the final precious knowledge of how dearly we still loved each other after all the weeping was done. And whoever is in charge of all this will walk with us and will help us to sort out the mysteries and help us to complete the healing. Walls will fall, and we will see each other more clearly, all of us, the Mormons and the Catholics and the Jews and the Muslims and the straights and the gays and the women and the men. Confusions will lift like fog lifts from the Golden Gate Bridge on a good summer day, and we will each see our next step and we'll take it. Gerald's insatiable hunger for learning will find ready fields. And I will smile as I see him bounding in with some bright new knowledge to share, very much as I saw him bounding up the stairs hundreds of times, his blonde head a rising sun. Blossom, did you know? Yeah. And John, I am not always as emotionally drawn back into this story. And I'm not going to apologize for it because I want everyone to know that every other story, the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands in our own culture deserve tears. Because today, right now, there are gay people and their families who are weeping. And who have some better tools to deal with it than Gerald and I did. But to a large extent, we are still in the dark ages about understanding this, about allowing it to be a topic of conversation that is not immediately covered with guilt and abomination. And so I'm glad to offer my emotional response to all this as an invitation to everybody to know that in their ward, in their stake, in their neighborhood, there are gay people who are in anguish, who are considering suicide at this very moment. There are parents who say, what have I done? How can I manage? How can I manage to love my church and love my gay child? There are people who weep every day in our community that ought to be much more of a Christ-like community, who want to understand, want to embrace, want to do what is really helpful to so many people, rather than feeling comfortable saying, oh, I know what to do. I will love the sinner and hate the sin. That's all I need to do. And it is so much the invitation that is out to our Mormon community to rise to what is obviously one of the biggest challenges in the church at this moment, in public relations and in inner activity, is so huge that I am happy to be one who says, here's the invitation. Stand up and do your part.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.